And good morning, everyone. I'm Mike Ferry with ONC, and I'd like to thank you for joining the Public Health Data Systems Task Force. We do have a few guest presenters with us today, and I'd like to thank them for their participation. All of our task force meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is always welcomed, either in the Zoom chat or during the public comment period that is scheduled about 11:50 Eastern Time this morning. I'm going to begin roll call with our task force members, so when I call your name, please indicate that you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Jillian Haney.
Present, good morning.
Arian Malik, I don't see online, but he should be joining us shortly. Rochelle Bolton.
Here.
Hans Gutendijk.
Good morning.
Heather Cook Sinclair.
Here.
Aaron Holt-Coyne.
Good morning.
Charles Cross.
Good morning.
Steve Eichner.
I think Steve texted he's going to be a bit late. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, right, great. Thank you. Joe Gibson.
Warren.
Raj Goodparty. Jim Gerges. John Kansky.
Good morning.
Bryant Thomas Karras. Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Jennifer Layden. Leslie Leonard. Hung Lu.
Good morning.
Mark Morostica.
Good morning.
Aaron Mary. Alexandra Muggy. Stephen Murphy.
Good morning.
Eliel Olivero.
Good morning.
Jamie Pina.
Present. Good morning.
Abby Sears.
Good morning.
Vivian Singletary. Bill Sutherland.
Good morning.
And Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much. And now please join me in welcoming Jillian for her opening remarks. Jillian.
Hi, thank you. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our seventh meeting. I'm going to actually sort of skip over my opening remarks this morning to so that we can get to our panelists and then ensure that we have got plenty of time for a very, what I'm sure will be a really robust discussion and get to have an opportunity to start reviewing some of the comments in the worksheets and developing consensus as we move forward with our draft recommendations. So today we're here to talk about the sixth of the F criteria, the transmission to public health agencies, antimicrobial use and antibiotic resistance reporting. And this is a bit of a unique criterion in that there's more than one data transmission that's in play here. So we have data that are going from healthcare providers to the National Healthcare Safety Network, NHSN, and those are focused on a specific infection type as they are sent up to the national level. And then we also have data that are coming through directly to jurisdictions that are case-based reporting on individuals who may have an antibiotic-resistant infection. We also have data that are collected in the aggregate in the form of antibiogram data, as well as individual providers, large provider system use of system. And those are also coming to jurisdictions in a variety of different methods. So there's a lot to unpack here. And it is, as I said, you know, different from a single stream reporting like we have in place for electronic laboratory reporting or cancer reporting. And so we should keep that in mind as we are listening to presentations and initiating discussions. So for our panelists this morning, we have two presenters and we'll be followed by someone who I think will be joining us a little bit later, who will also be able to speak to their perspective from a healthcare provider. And first up, we have Christina Brandenburg from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health and Dr. Xu Hu from the CDC. So welcome to you both. And I'm not sure who was supposed to be speaking first. So she was, Wu, welcome. You have the floor.
Okay. Sure. Good morning, everyone. My name is Xu Wu. I'm a medical epidemiologist and AUR team lead. Today, I'm going to give you an overview about the CDC's National Health Safety Network, or NHSN. So NHSN launched the antimicrobial use and resistance, or AUR module. First, the antimicrobial use option, or AU option, in 2011, and later the AR option in 2014. The AU and AR reporting was added to the MU3 program as a reporting option under public health registry in January 2017. Next slide, please. The NHSN AUR module receives data that are extracted from hospital information systems and submitted by facilities directly to the NHSN. After data submission on NHSN application, the users can compare their data against national benchmarks, as well as perform data visualizations. These functionalities are available for individual facilities and group users, such as state and local health departments. The CDC can also use these data to generate national statistics. Next, please. And CDC NHSN's requirement for data submission is from the hospitals that have proper source of data, which include the admission, discharge, and transfer, or ADT system. And for AU, those have electronic administration record, medication administration record, or EMR, or barcoding medication administration, or BCMA systems. And for AR, those have laboratory information system, or LIS, or an electronic health record that directly connected to an LIS system. Additionally, the reporting sites must have the ability to package data using HL7 standardized clinical document architecture, or CDA. This can be done by their internal IT resources or by hiring commercial software vendors that are certified by the ONC's Standard Version Advancement Process, or SVAP. Next, please. Let's take a closer look at how data are extracted and handled. First, vendors or homegrown software will map their facility's local codes to a set of standardized codes, including organism, drugs, and patient care locations. Then, vendor or homegrown software select the right records and aggregate data. Finally, software package the data and then submit to NHSN. All these steps need to follow the NHSN AUR protocol and implementation guide. The CDA files that are not following the specified implementation guide will be rejected by the NHSN application. Next. To make sure the implementers can correctly select and aggregate data, NHSN created the AUR synthetic data sets, or SDS, which will be used to test and validate the implementer's data processing capability. NHSN issues SDS validation ID for the vendors that pass the validation to include in their CDA files. The SDS validation ID is required for data submission. Next one. So we're facing several challenges. First, data quality is very important for us since systemic error can occur with electronic reporting. We noticed that terminology mapping from local codes to the standard codes is the most common source of error. The standardized terminology systems such as LOINC and RxNorm are not universally used across facilities. Therefore, various level of interpretation and mapping needs to be done by the facilities or the vendors. This introduced the possibility for error and inconsistency across facilities. And second, when we are moving from current state to the future state where we want to leverage the fast healthcare interoperability resources, or FHIR, for data collection, some data elements that are required for AUR and other important surveillance are not readily available in the current fire environment, such as medication administration. Unless resources like medication administration are made available in fire APIs and are set up in a truly standardized manner, surveillance will not be able to depend on new and evolving approaches to interoperability like fire. Next. And third, on the AR side of reporting, we notice that AST or antimicrobial susceptibility testing results are not complete for some drugs in some facilities. We found it is actually because of data suppression, also known as selective or cascade reporting. This is an antimicrobial stewardship practice, which is to omit the results for certain drugs from prescriber's view. This practice is good for stewardship, but on the other hand, can bias surveillance results. We found that data suppression can happen on LIS, EHR, or even on the testing instrument. And if AR data are extracted from downstream of where the data suppression happens, the data are incomplete and potentially biased. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wu. Our next presenter is Christina Brandenburg, an epidemiologist with the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. Welcome, Christina.
Thanks. Great. So again, my name is Christina Brandenburg. I'm one of the epidemiologists and a HAI AR analytic coordinator with the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. Go to the next slide. So in Massachusetts, there are several antimicrobial resistance data sources that are used. The first are multi-drug resistant organism cases that are reported to the state health department through electronic lab reporting. This includes Enterobacterales from any source with resistance to ertapenem, imipenem, meropenem, or doripenem. We also have Enterobacterales demonstrating carbapenemase production of KPC, NDM, OXA, IMP, or VIM, and Candida auris. We don't require ELR reporting, but we do request isolates to be sent to the state laboratory for carbapenem-resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa that are non-susceptible to cefepime or ceftazidime, as well as carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter baumannii. We also have access to resistance data for events that are reported through NHSN's patient safety component by both our acute care and non-acute care hospitals. This includes central line-associated bloodstream infections, catheter-associated urinary tract infections, and secondary infections. And also once a year, Massachusetts acute care hospitals report aggregate antibiogram data directly to the state health department. For antimicrobial use, we have a number of our acute care hospitals that have voluntarily provided us group access to the AU data that they're reporting into NHSN. We also have some long-term care facilities who are voluntarily reporting monthly aggregate antimicrobial starts directed to the state health department. And we've conducted analyses of outpatient antimicrobial use using all payer claims data. Go to the next slide. This is a side-by-side comparison of the different NHSN AR data sources, and it's available on their website. We've also included a comparison to our state MDRO surveillance data. All of these options do provide patient-level information, but I will mention when it comes to the NHSN AU module, that is reported in aggregate, so we're not able to stratify by patient demographics. One benefit to using NHSN and state MDRO data is that there are standard event and surveillance definitions that are used. So we're able to compare data across different facilities, different geographical areas within Massachusetts. We don't currently have access to AR module data in NHSN, but we've heard that starting in 2024, that AR and AU module data will be required to be reported. And with both of those modules, AR and AU, as was mentioned earlier, the data is uploaded using clinical document architecture. It's great because there's no manual data entry, but we have heard, you know, the barrier among facilities is that they have to do that initial setup using either vendor or homegrown system. And there's also an extensive data validation process initially, as well as on an annual basis. We do get additional resistance data through NHSN's MDRO device and procedure associated modules. The MDRO module reporting is simplified, but it does only include a small number of organisms. As I mentioned, with all the NHSN modules, there are standard event definitions, which is great because there are national benchmarks that facilities in the states can compare their data to. But one thing we have to keep in mind is that only infections that actually do meet those definitions would actually be reported into NHSN and would have resistance data available. For these three modules, facilities do have the option to manually enter data into NHSN, but we have heard that that's quite a burden on infection control programs at the facilities. We have heard that some of our Massachusetts hospitals have worked with their IT departments in order to actually upload data using either CDA or CSV files, but we know that's not universal among all of our facilities. To quickly touch on our Massachusetts surveillance data, the source is comprehensive for carbapenem-resistant organisms and C. auris. However, state epidemiologists do conduct manual filtering of lab results because it's difficult for facilities to set up an algorithm that it exactly matches our reporting requirements for sending those susceptibility data to the state health department via ELR. As mentioned earlier, facilities do have access to data reported in NHSN, and there's a number of reports that they can generate within the system. And we also know that they work really closely with their laboratory and pharmacy partners to review internal reports during quality improvement meetings. For our required and voluntary reporting, the State Health Department does provide feedback reports to facilities. For the NHSN AU data that facilities are voluntarily reporting, we do send reports on a biannual basis so that they can see what they have actually reported compared to state data that all our facilities that have conferred rights to us. We also send long-term care facilities quarterly reports that summarize the antibiotic start data that they're reporting to us. Again, this compares the data that they've submitted compared to aggregate data among the facilities that are participating in the program. And we also do summarize the MDRO surveillance data we collect by distributing a quarterly aggregate state summary to facilities. I think with that, I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Dr. Wu and Christina. I really appreciate that. I think you really put forth the complexities with these data. And you know, there is a really critical need right now to be collecting these data and making use of them. But I think that there are some real opportunities to make some recommendations about potentially moving towards a reduced provider burden, as well as making some recommendations about how, you know, the origin of these data are captured and sent. So let's bring it open to discussion. Les, I see your hand is raised.
Sure, just wanted to talk a little bit about whether there are plans to transition this reporting structure to FHIR and what those look like. Obviously CCD is great. It is NHSN has been one of the leaders in provisioning of automated data from health systems, but the landscape is changing, and the document architecture is probably not where the puck will be in 5 years. So what's the plans on what's the thoughts on that, and what are CDC's plans and public health's plans?
I think we heard from Dr. Wu that there are some concerns about the, you know, rapid uptake from FHIR because some data are not readily available, such as medications. Dr. Wu, do you want to speak further about that?
Yeah, sure. The current version of AUR surveillance, we received some feedbacks from the field that because of the limited data elements, data is currently collected, aggregated on the AU side. So we are not able to do some patient level risk adjustment. So we are really looking into and have high hope for FHIR. But when we take a closer look, we found that first, medication administration is not a readily available data element. in the fire environment, and as well as some other patient level data elements are not like standard in the fire environment, but we're still looking, and hopefully can in the future, if there are any certification or standards, can guide the facilities and collect the elements that we need for AUR. That is our next step, so to move IUR to the fire environment.
So you're working on that, but you think that there are still gaps in the ability to read MAR records inside of fire. And do you have some academic partners or other people you're working with to redefine that? I know that, you know, inside of, I would suspect that inside of many commercial electronic records now, with the emphasis on fire interfaces, that interrogation of, you know, getting at medication administration is not an issue. I would have thought it was more an issue perhaps with, you know, getting at antibiotic susceptibility profiles or other things, because the maybe the standards need to be extended in those areas so that we had better representations of that within fire. Are there any places where you would like to see standards extended?
Our first step is to look into AU. So AR part, we haven't done like extensive evaluation yet. And there are other energy system modules are thinking of getting patient level data via fire. So several patient level and facility admission, discharge and transfer systems for the denominators are considered, and we're working with several collaboration sites on exploring and evaluating the feasibility and the terminology, and we do see several potential barriers, but when we start to pilot with these collaborations, I will be able to see a more clear picture, like what exactly the data elements are not. Like, we can have a list, but that so far that we know, like, admission and medication administration is not available is on the AUR side. Is what I am the most concerned about.
Are you working with the Helios initiative to see how bulk fire could be utilized to provision data in this setting?
I'm not familiar with, is that an organization that?
It is one of CDC's initiatives, but it's in, you know, OCELS.
Sorry, can you say that again?
Helios, it's a CDC initiative. It's in OCELS.
Okay, we'll look into that.
Thank you, Les. Abigail, so you have your hand up?
Yeah, so just a couple of things. So actually, Leslie, I think also it's sometimes a matter of who's on the phone. So Andrea Bennett, who is the chief of our surveillance branch where AUAR is housed, is familiar with Helios. I think to your point, and also just kind of getting back to this, and frankly also to the charge of this committee, you know, we are trying to straddle this, you know, when you require this of all hospitals, or at least all hospitals in the PIP, you have, you know, people who are very much on the leading edge, and then you have the folks who barely got to the CDA. And so, you know, we are in some ways constrained. We want to move forward, but also create, you know, a way for the laggards to come. So it is really a challenge. And the more that this committee can help us, you know, raise the floor for providers, so that fire is not this leading, bleeding edge. It's increasingly, you know, the standard, you know, that's, I think that's what we are sort of wrestling with here. But thank you. Yes, we are familiar with Helios. It's just, you know, who's touching what parts of the elephant of CDC sometimes.
You know, and I know that we talk a lot about fire and moving towards, you know, adoption of fire for public health, but I think that there still remains to be seen, like whether fire will really stand up for public health. I know that, you know, Helios has got three different initiatives going forward in pilot projects, and hopefully we'll be able to realize some of those benefits soon. But I think there is some anxiety about putting all of our eggs in one basket. Other comments or questions for the presenters? We're a quiet group today. Well, I think that actually will lend itself to for a good thing. So we will be able to move forward to our tracker worksheet and actually spend some time reviewing some of the comments and recommendations that have been put forth. I just wanted to thank Dr. Wu and Christina for setting the field and presenting towards us today. You're welcome to stay on the call, but you are officially released as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you,
Jillian. This is one last thing. I think one thing that Sho said, and I think you'll probably get into your track, it's in your tracker too, is this system of systems issue, where if we only have, you know, fire and standards at one part, but we're pulling from multiple systems like, you know, LIS and lab stuff. If we get one part of the system moving forward, but the other ones are not, so you mentioned public health, but I would also ask and mention like lab systems. If we're not all moving forward together, that's something that we are really challenged by, especially in a system like AUAR, where it actually needs to pull from multiple other systems, whether directly to the EHR or separately. So just wanted to underscore that before you guys went into this, because I know that's come up and that's kind of a key theme for us.
No, and I think that the presenters both, you know, demonstrated that very clearly about how the data are being pulled from multiple sources, and they're also being captured differently, both in like individual case level or laboratory reporting results versus aggregated data as well. So thank you. And point taken. So I see that Liz has pulled up our tracker sheet, and I believe that my co-presenter is on. Arian,
good morning.
Good morning.
Apologies, it must have been I slept a ridiculously long time last night, so must still be dealing with post-COVID fatigue.
And it's also very early on the West Coast, so we should acknowledge that as well.
here we are. We do schedule these things at times that I can normally be awake, but apparently today I was not. Just wanted to do a brief note in terms of process here. I've heard some concerns or some questions on the overall process, and I think most of that's been secondary to just not having enough time to dig through each of these recommendations. But I'll take on some of the questions on process and be happy to respond to any other questions that folks might have. First of all, the general status of anything that we propose here in the spreadsheet. The goal of this material is to make it into a draft transmittal letter. And I emphasize, you know, both that this is a source material spreadsheet and that the draft material, the draft transmittal is draft until roundabout early to mid November, where it has to be near final and we're in sort of our final editing pass and wordsmithing, but we've got a sense of our recommendations. So this month is the month where we get into the nitty-gritty, make sure that we're carrying forward to the transmittal a set of recommendations that we generally agree on, which gets us to the, and once we transfer information from the spreadsheet to the transmittal, it is not at that point locked and locked in stone. It is still a draft that we will be actively engaging in, wordsmithing on, et cetera. But you know, that step of transferring from the spreadsheet to the transmittal letter really should be done with recommendations that we believe represent the consensus of the work group. Second is, you know, our decisional process in all of the task forces that I've worked on is, call it 99% consensus oriented. And consensus means that there is general agreement and no strong objection to carrying forward recommendations that represent these recommendations represent the opinion of the task force. We've had a couple of issues, rare, where we have had strong inter-task force disagreement, and we've coalesced on two potential recommendations. In those cases, we have two options. One is just to drop the recommendation if it's not that important. You know, if we're really arguing over the not most material topics that ONC should be considered. In other cases, we have carried forward. We've gone through a formal vote and then carried forward two opinions, a majority opinion, a minority opinion. Sometimes we try to make our wording very clear that, you know, it is strong and, you know, near majority opinion, et cetera. I would expect those kinds of situations to be rare because our goal is to achieve consensus. So sort of two really important bits. Number one is we aim to put forward recommendations that represent the consensus of the task force. We are in draft mode. The spreadsheet is an idea collection tool. The transmittal is a drafting tool. But in either of those cases, we are in draft mode until, you know, early November, in which case we're in near final mode. We deal with disagreement generally by modifying the recommendations to the point where they address the consensus of the task force, which doesn't mean that, you know, like anything else, and people have gone through this work before, like anything else, it doesn't mean consensus doesn't mean, you know, you argue for every comma and every, you know, dot of T and every word choice. It means that we have a set of recommendations we can carry forward that that represents the will of the task force and doesn't engender strong disagreement. I think those were all the key considerations. I think Jillian had a suggestion for a glossary. I think if there are terms that we want to define and make sure that they're very clear, we should be doing that. And then, you know, in general, if there are recommendations that are in the spreadsheet that people disagree with strongly, and we've heard some of those. So for example, the division of labor between syndromic surveillance and ECR or ELR, you know, the notion of broad, anonymized, de-identified sweeps versus information that's narrowly targeted for case investigation and is personally identifiable. When we hear those disagreements, please raise your hand, express your disagreement. I don't think this is a shy group. And we do want to make sure that if there's anything that we are proposing carrying forward to the transmittal that people do not think is appropriate to carry forward to the transmittal, we definitely want to hear about that as early as possible. Jillian, anything else that I missed in terms of that recital of process?
Nope, I think that's good. There is a question from Hans just to clarify the color coding.
Yes, and the updated clarity of color coding, we've done a revision of the wording here. Green means we're locked in the spreadsheet as we've moved to the transmittal working document, and so there will be opportunity to put comments onto the transmittal working document. I don't know if we've publicized the transmittal working document broadly to the group, but we will. Yellow, we have been, as I think people can appreciate, we have been so heads down doing these hearings Getting the Q&A and then going through the rather shallow dives. Yellow means we've got the work in progress. We've discussed it. It's still in progress. And gray, red is a duplicate, and the default non-shaded color is that we have not yet gone through a deep dive. So Hans, hopefully that addresses your question.
So thanks for that, Arian. And I think all of this, I think it should be also just want to note that we spent a lot of time trying to set the level set in terms of the criteria that we are working with, and what the complexities of each of those data streams are. And we haven't really had a lot of opportunity to really start diving into proposed recommendations and some of the comments. So we have one more criteria, which are healthcare surveys, to address next week. And then we will be full speed ahead on in discussion mode. So thank you.
Jeff asked about public comment and public availability. Our intent is to take the draft transmittal letter and make the then current version available in the meeting materials for the meeting. This document is a fast moving document, so there's no really good mechanism for locking it down and providing a copy of it. It really is an input tool. But as we get to draft transmittal, we do intend to take the draft transmittal and publish the then current version as meeting material. It will be out of date by the time that we end a meeting, but we can catch up with it by the next meeting. So for folks who aren't able to attend these meetings but want to sort of get a sense for what the current state of discussions are, we do intend to make that draft transmittal available. And yellow means that we are in progress in the conversation. There's a helpful instruction sheet on the tab one. All right. So let us pick a topic. I think we've already hit, hit the drop down for a second, Liz. Other one.
There was one just sort of point that I put in the sort of an overarching comment that there are places that public health is referred to as public health stakeholders, and we're really public health authorities because we have legal responsibilities. Yeah. And I think that it would be, and I think that there is an official CMS term as the designated public health authority. So yeah. I'd like to recommend that we use that language instead of stakeholder.
Jillian, happy to use whatever language you think is appropriate. I meant to be inclusive of CSTE, of other national, era, other national public health organizations of public health authorities. That have important input, who are not themselves legally designated public health authorities, as far as I understand.
Got it. Yeah, so, I think there are a couple of places that where we can reflect that nuance.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so if you can come up with alternative language, happy to let's just be consistent and draft it in consistently, and or define a term and make sure people are aware that we expect, which I know the CDC does, but we expect CDC to consult with STILTS. We expect CDC to consult with national organizations, et cetera. Should we go to syndromic surveillance? I don't think we've hit syndromic yet.
Sounds good.
All right. Let me get my chat disposed of. So this topic of that engendered a fair bit of discussion and lack of consensus is the topic that there is overlap between syndromic surveillance and other forms of PHI carrying data reporting. I think we heard from the public health stakeholders there was a pretty profound disagreement with the notion that we should be treating these two classes of information equivalently. I'm going to try to see if I can represent the sense of the public health community which is, hey, syndromic surveillance is necessarily and by design noisy. It is de-identified. It is used for identifying hypotheses and possible trends. The fact that it is the fact that it is large aggregates of lots of noisy data and does not and lacks the precision of ELR or ECR, et cetera, is by design. And it would be problematic to try to reconcile those two pieces of information because one is designed to be anonymized and de-identified in most cases. I think some folks are going to remind us that in some states there is collection by policy of non-de-identified data, but it is de-identified at some stage in the pipeline, and that you know the data that informs, for example, case investigation is necessarily and by design very detailed and very precise. And also lags the case by some period of time because it is precise. And that number three, so that because of those two things, there really is no need to harmonize the data between those two views. Ike, you have a question.
Not so much of a question, but I was thinking about it in the way that yesterday as I was looking at a presentation from the Sequoia project. And it laid out the idea on the healthcare provider side that there are specialty systems within the hospital that may focus on things like oncology or medication administration or other practice-specific activities within the hospital environment. It had occurred to me we can describe public health systems in the same type of way as we're looking at specialty systems within the overarching public health umbrella, looking at things like syndromic surveillance and case investigations and other activities that are not just data, they're programmatic activities within the public health domain. And just like in the private or the healthcare provider sense, you might not have the exact same data you want between an oncology system and a medication administration system. It's a direct parallel with data needs on the public health side.
Ike, that brings up another point that I forgot to mention, which is, you know, what would we propose certifying? And this is going to turn into a very short history lesson, but the EHR certification program started as a Big Bang functional certification program. And has evolved to be a modular interoperability focused certification program. It's not always perfect, not always gets to that state of ideal, but that's been the general evolution. And the way that the certification world has evolved is that we certify to interoperability standards and associated implementation guidance with certification criteria, and then some other federal authority, not ONC, attaches certification criteria to programmatics and provides flexibility to providers and hospitals to assemble technology to address the needs of their programmatics with certified technology. I would anticipate the same thing happening for public health. We would certify a syndromic surveillance interoperability criterion. Technology vendors, public health developers, et cetera, would be free to adopt those certification criteria and be certified for the components where they require a syndromic surveillance interface. We would not be certifying syndromic surveillance systems, the functionality and needs of those systems. We would be certifying to the interface specification, both content and semantics. And then CDC would attach, for example, requirements to use certified technology for syndromic surveillance grants, at which point public health authorities would assemble, and I've got some language in the spreadsheet to try to be a little more precise here, would assemble the technology fit for purpose consistent with their policies out of certified technology, choosing in some cases to self-certify the implementation that they've built. So Hans is our resident expert on certification, but also was the originator of this item. So Hans, we'll go over to you.
Yeah, thank you, Arjen. And I just want to follow up a little bit more on some of the discussion around de-identified data. And clearly that makes it different than ELR, ECR, and has a different nature in it. And no argument there. But there are situations that that there are directives out there from jurisdiction to include PHI in syndromic surveillance and continue to report that way. So there is this element of not strictly de-identified, more chatty, et cetera, which actually still may have some optimization opportunities with others, maybe not specifically ECR, but from a complete, or it might be with SANO or some combination. There's still a potential question, at least around how do we deal with de-identified data, and is there a need for complete record, or is it just the events, and that's a different story. But there is that element of PHI that does trickle into syndromic surveillance, which maintains then a underlying question of, in those scenarios, are we really using optimized flow for that, and are we starting to mix purposes as PHI is flowing into the transactions? If it were strictly PHI or no PHI included in a transaction, I understand the other arguments better. But as there are PHI data flowing in various instances into syndromic surveillance, that still begs the question for, are we using the optimized flows there? And so maybe we need to narrow it and have it as a something to be explored, still as an optimization and align, perhaps a couple of different ones here.
Yep, got it. And then Arjen, I think, appropriately points out that syndromic surveillance by definition is intended to be broad and all-encompassing.
Which is fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I just would add it just to make that point a little bit more expressively. You know, we are using syndromic surveillance for injury surveillance, for example, looking at suicides, looking at motor vehicle accidents, looking at opioid overdoses, whereas, you know, electronic case reporting is very disease specific, ranging from a specific cancer to a to something like salmonellosis. So they're really two very, very different data streams.
So
and sometimes we attempt to try to marry them up, but yeah.
Maybe the consensus here is we should be aligning the syndromic surveillance implementation guide to other standards and to US CDI, not to marry up data or for any purpose like that, but simply to lower the implementation burden for implementing to the syndromic surveillance guide. But I haven't heard that implementing the syndromic surveillance guide is problematic, is generally problematic anyway, because it uses a pretty standard ADT feed. I haven't heard anything about the burden of implementing the syndromic surveillance guide, but that would be the one argument that I could see is, hey, if we're requiring totally different data in the syndromic surveillance guide, but it's actually the same data that we require in US CDI in different contexts, we probably should harmonize those two guides.
And the UCDI, that's not quite a guide. That's more a set of data with a scope.
Understood. But you get my point that if we're modeling data, if the underlying data model that underlies syndromic surveillance is that radically different from the underlying US CDI V3 data model, then by definition, the implementation guides will have the same data, but represented differently, which would cause an implementation burden. But again, I haven't heard that as being a major concern from implementers.
No, not at this point in time. Okay. It's a general longer term opportunity that data is consistently represented, whatever it is, across whatever standard is used.
Good. Okay. So Hans, would you mind taking another crack at this one and really focusing on the as we continue to maintain the syndromic surveillance guide, seek opportunities to align to common standards?
Happy to address one question that has not been addressed yet that I raised. How to consider these situations where PHI does start to trickle into syndromic surveillance transactions? How do we consider that, because that's where the lines are starting to get blurred. The ones before, I understand fully the variety of triggers. That's not the same as ESR, ECR. Clearly, ECR triggers are expanding as well. There's a common a method that is starting to be to evolve out of the variety of transactions that we have, whether they are reportable conditions for ELR, for ECR, for syndromic surveillance. There is that knowledge base about when this trigger happens, I want to get this set of data that, depending on the circumstance, can be communicated, identifiable or de-identifiable, and the lines can shift based on these types of letter of directives. That type of a common approach where we can optimize the data flows more consistently, as you also pointed out, whether that's you align with USCDI, you align with FHIR, you align with something there, that consistency can help tremendously improve on the on the type of exchanges that we have.
Gotcha. Hans, let me repeat back what I'm hearing you say, which is during the pandemic, there were cases where local jurisdictions used the existing syndromic surveillance. So first of all, there's been a point that many of our public health practitioners have pointed out to us that by state law, the anonymization or de-identification of syndromic surveillance data varies. And there are cases where it is de-identified from origination. There were cases where it's processed in the locality and then de-identified prior to streaming up to CDC and to BioSense 2. The second point that you're making is there were cases during the pandemic where we sought to use the existing feeds because they were up and running to collect additional triggered information in ways that maybe did overlap with EICR, or were capturing additional contextual information at a population level. And both Ike and Jillian are able to answer this question. So,
and just to clarify, not specifically COVID necessary or pandemic, I'm looking at one or have that would be August of 2022. So from that perspective, I'm not sure whether that's pandemic related or whether that is another purpose, but it's certainly recent.
Got it. Ike, do you want to?
Well, two pieces, I think. First, looking at jurisdictions do have the right and potentially different interests and provide different services to their different communities, so that in some cases they may need identifiable information in support of other services. Also, I think as we're looking at more holistically, looking at the data, there does need to be alignment between the data that's being included in submissions and USCDI, and ensuring that there is consistency kind of on a go-forward basis, that the standards are not outpacing the availability of data. That would also apply to things in SFAP, that we can't get ahead of ourselves in terms of looking at what's certified and what's not certified, because as soon as we have that difference, we're going to break interoperability again.
Thank you. Jillian?
Yeah, I think regarding the issues around identifiability, I would classify syndromic surveillance as a partially de-identified data set. There does contain some PHI in there, and there are some jurisdictions that do request a fully identified data set that are sent before stripping them of some of those identifiers before going to CDC. And there are legal reasons for doing that, legal privacy reasons within the states for doing that. So we are, you know, I think that the authority of public health, you know, I think that we are getting into some legal issues in terms of what information can be shared with our federal partners. And what information and how syndromic surveillance is used as well for non-infectious diseases. There are legal constraints in terms of what can be reported. And you know, when does something become a cluster that will enable it to become further identified to be able to obtain further identifiable information. I mean, the legal authority with electronic case reporting is very straightforward in terms of the access to fully identifiable information, whereas with syndromic surveillance, it's a different set of rules that are in place.
We're at risk at this point of beating this particular horse. Where I'm hearing consensus is it would be appropriate to make sure that our ongoing reviews and maintenance of the syndromic surveillance implementation guide be kept consistent with the general standards ecosystem to reduce implementation burden. Where I hear strong disagreement is that we should explicitly design syndromic surveillance interfaces to better harmonize with ELR or EICR for the purposes of data reconciliation. And then I'm hearing some emerging public health use cases to go to some hybrid or more sophisticated event-based notification systems that get a more granular information in some situations. And this is either going to go in the realm of there's an emerging public health use case and ONC and CDC should assemble and coordinate the creation of appropriate standards and certification guidance, or this goes into states and localities have broad legal authority, and what we're doing is designing a national floor, not creating a machine that can address all state by state variation, but hopefully by creating a national floor that is higher than the current national floor, we have significantly reduce the need for state by state variation. I think that's what my consensus is as I'm my recitation of what I believe is the consensus of the group. I think Stephen and Hans had some good comments in terms of the alignment, standards alignment point. If we could do another pass of this recommendation in ways that are more targeted towards standards alignment and less targeted for data, for alignment of data for the purposes of downstream reporting. Hans, is that something you can do?
Yes, and I also heard the term event-based reporting. Yep. I like that. There's quite a variety of them out there, whether they are ECR-like, ELR-like, syndromic-like. So I think we can work with that to pull something together.
Perfect, yeah. So if you could draft a recommendation there for consideration, just yep. In terms of, hey, there's this emerging use case and it might be appropriate for ONC and CDC to work with federal partners to convene stakeholders to yada, yada, yada. All right. Okay, let's go on to our next one. Okay, so this is our general note that we've got named standards in certification criteria that may not be the latest version, and we should update to the latest version. This is a general, we've seen this comment in a number of places. Strong opinions, disagreements.
I can't fully see what Aaron's comment is. Thank you.
So I think there's a cautious belief that we should support the advancement of standards, but also be aware of the burden of implementation of new versions of standards and make sure that we're not implicitly creating unfunded mandates on public health or creating updates to standards outside of predictable windows that are aligned with granting or aligned with procurement windows. which yes, I think Hans could tell you, or other some of our provider organizations could tell you how much work it takes to keep up with a certification program once we have one.
And but once you can align them, it starts to become easier to.
There is a one time, but just again, the nature of doing a certification program is there's a one time hit. And then the more that ONC, and ONC's done a good job with the SFAP, can telegraph telegraph via the SFAP standards enhancements, and make sure that industry is ready for the next iteration, and those iteration cycles are relatively predictable, then it does become a little more like a machine. Hans, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, since the this is a topic general, and whether this is syndromic surveillance, this will come back in other ones as well, of going to a more current one, whether there is that opportunity to provide a recommendation that that it is important to start to look at staying current, recognizing for all parties, it's across the board, the effort to get up for what value do you get, is that the right time to do? We're going to run into that over the next couple of years with fire as well. So that is an important balance. But at this point in time, the lessons learned from before, is syndromic surveillance already ready to move up? Or do we say is that no, it's working well, but in light of the other comments, let's figure that out first before we need to strongly recommend to go to a more current version in that environment. And that depends on, can we already get value out of the additional version uptick in the meantime? And that depends on, do we think from a public health perspective in particular, that it provides content and data that otherwise would not have been able to as easily be obtained?
Yeah, when we get to the general section, I've drafted some recommendations talking about the notion of a phased approach, talking about the notion of flexibility. This has been a perennial challenge as we've been doing certification-based upgrades of the HIT system. And I don't think it will be new to ONC, but did want to make it's been a topic that we've discussed repeatedly and wanted to make sure that we sort of memorialized as a recommendation. Why don't we go on to the next one? So Hans, if you can, Hans, and I think you and Stephen co-collaborated on this one. If we could, if just your thoughts about whether we recommend updating to the latest, or whether we need an omnibus updating to the latest and aligning standards recommendation.
This was with ICON to be adopted standard. So. Do you want to comment on that, on how the conversation was and
how
you balanced the approach?
Yeah.
For the adopted standards task force, we looked at 55 standards that were included in regulation and the responsibility of ONC and made recommendations to ONC through HITECH, looking at whether those standards should be maintained or retired. For most of the standards, syndromic surveillance included, we recognized that the current standard in place may be a little bit out of date, and there may be additional standards or a new standard that is ready to be implemented, but there needs to be regulatory action taken to move that into regulation at the next available time, or the next time the regulations get open for change. Syndromic surveillance was one of those that was included in that space. But again, the necessary resources have to be available for public health to implement as well as providers to adopt. That's pretty much where it's at.
Yep. Okay. So we could maybe just ask if we can create an omnibus recommendation here that, and it sounds like the adopted standard, I remember seeing this, that the adopted standards task force did a lot of good work in already doing some of this pre-analysis. If we could do a general recommendation to this nature rather than area by area, that might be easier to read, but again, defer to the folks who are willing to put in the work to do this work. Otherwise, we'll just carry these recommendations forward.
I think it could be done as a single general recommendation. Again, recognizing that there've got to be the right resources in place to adopt. And if we're looking at doing things out of cycle, we need to be cautious about backward compatibility and breaking systems. And do we certify an SFAP implemented activity against what criterion, and what happens if it's done off cycle?
Absolutely. You'll see, again, when we get to the recommendation in the general recommendations, which maybe we should go to after we do this one, you'll see that, as I said, I tried to draft some of the recommendations or some recommendation text to address that point that we've been discussing. Okay, next one is from Les, which is on SANR and situational awareness. So we're gonna punt this one from syndromic surveillance and move it to other. And then we already have another section here. So Les, this is not by way of invalidating this point, but just by way of saying that the general point here is that we have identified two areas of public health standards, implementation guidance, and potential certification where there are data flows, but no adopted standard. One of them is vital health statistics. The other is this one of situational awareness. So we're gonna move this one to the other category and then address it in that context. So point on communication infrastructure for disaster and situational awareness. I'd say I think the general point on situational awareness belongs in the other category. Telecom communication granting. I would believe would be outside of our scope for reviewing the F criteria and related criteria for public health data flows. So we can bring it up. But I believe that this would be an out of scope item. Oh no, we violated our rules. All right. Hans notes that we have in the syndromic surveillance value set list, lists that are not as granular as captured in systems are required by jurisdictions. And we should align on terminology sets for syndromic surveillance as well as for other implementation guides that we're drawing from common value sets and have the ability to create appropriate value subsets. Did I capture your comment right, Hans?
Correct. Yep. We're finding that in a number of instances that a comment set will be helpful.
Yep. Any other comments on this point, or should we proceed on?
Maybe one additional comment that has both a consistency of reporting at the initial report, but then also the downstream and analytical aspect of having consistency wherever you can on analysis.
Yep, and so again, this is just the general point that it would be in areas where even if the need is different and even if the context for use is different, to the extent that we can align the underlying standards, we're reducing implementation burden. Let's go to the next one, in which Hans is yours. If maybe we just defer over to you to.
You're looking at 58 or 57? 58. So there are some, this is a timing question, and it goes back as to is that okay or not, but that some of the data that is desirable for syndromic surveillance is not necessarily at the time of an ADT event. It becomes known later, and therefore you have that question of how do you gather that, and how do you include that? How do you trigger it so that the amount of data that is of interest for that particular trigger that it's made available? So that's a challenge that goes back then to if you are going to split the syndromic surveillance transactions into multiple, so you can get that additional data. And particularly if you're in a de-identified space, now we have the challenge on how do we merge them back together after the data is already de-identified. So I think it's just pointing out a challenge that that we need to get better understanding and consideration of what data set is relevant and appropriate, recognizing that the registration, the admission, the discharge is not always the best time, or it's just not available. It won't become available until later, or it's just not available because it was not provided. That creates some challenge in my expectations and content. So hence the suggestion, and yeah, it goes back and this needs to then flash back to the other one. How can we marry up some of those flows so that data at different stages can be linked back up again. We've had the more in-depth discussion on where there are areas where syndromic surveillance just cannot take advantage of ECR or other identifiable data streams. But are there opportunities there where it can, particularly if it's becoming semi-identifiable otherwise? So I think it just is part of this overall. It is not a very optimized flow in light of where the data and when the data is captured and becomes available.
Yeah, I'm going back to the Jillian's point that syndromic surveillance is noisy and voluminous by design.
Right.
I haven't heard public health say, I'd rather get data a little bit later and get more precision on it. Okay, let's move on then. Standards conflicts, Hans. I see. So this is
a general theme.
This is your point that there's a base syndromic surveillance implementation guide, and then there is state by state variation. I think our recommendation here would be a request for ONC to convene, appropriate work to ensure that the chosen implementation guide addresses, it truly is a floor guide that raises above the existing floor to reduce state-by-state variation.
Yes, and and here the reference to ECR is not on the content, it's more about
the process, understood.
Technique of how can you share the knowledge of who needs what under what conditions so that it becomes easier to stay up to date and to then adjust the content accordingly.
And then sort of the same, this is 60 is about, is the same point, just at a more granular level of detail.
Yes, then it's about the data itself. So what are the triggers? What's the data? What are the variations? Is there an opportunity for, and we could combine that into one, there's a need for consistent knowledge that we can share, maintain, and akin to how ECR is starting to do it.
Sure. Any objections to that point? The general point being we should be continuing to develop and align the syndromic surveillance survey state needs, STILT needs, and ensure that we have a guide, an implementation guide that addresses appropriate variation in order to reduce implementation burden. No objection.
I concur.
Yep.
I think you can skip 61 because that's, we already discussed it. It's somehow up as a duplicate.
Okay. And then 64, I think, is the point that we were raising previously, that it would be desirable to have a standard by which public health can push alerts to provider organizations, or push updates to provider organizations. I don't believe that's syndromic surveillance. I would request that we just retag this one as other and discuss it when we get to the other. Maybe we can move to overarching at this point. All right. And we got a lot of overarching.
Arian, one thing I wanted to mention, as we're thinking about a central repository of information, I do want to remind folks about promoting interoperability and meaningful use, that there was originally a requirement that CMS develop a directory of information about public health engagement for meaningful use. And there were a couple of different initiatives or efforts put together to develop it, but it was never successful.
Appreciate that. So we should do that. We should have done that. Let's do it again.
Not better or worse. Just in the context of Hans's suggestion of looking at developing a national directory or a national resource in that space. We do have some history about trying to develop it and recognizing that it can be challenging.
Right. Well, and again, I think Hans points out that we've got a collaboration model in EICR that's been very successful. We've had a collaboration model with ERA that's been very successful. So in more targeted areas, rather than sort of general public health information, data flows, and we have this task force, which hopefully will be very successful. But these long lasting initiatives tend to be more successful when they are more focused on a particular public health need, and less successful when they're sort of general informatics governing societies, would be the gloss that I would have on that. We do have success models, is all I'm saying.
And to pull the curtain back a little bit about looking at EICR work, within each state, there can be an awful lot of effort, and there is an awful lot of effort being put forth in coordinating efforts between state and local jurisdictions as well. So it's not, while there is a good model in place, there really are an awful lot of moving parts in that space that it's not as easy as it might be.
No doubt. All right, let's go on to overarching number one. So 63, we've got, this is the general comment that we've heard, which is, the need to, capture really a floor level of necessary data, the ability to capture updated race ethnicity data, above and beyond the five plus two OMB race ethnicity codes. The need to consider certification that's not just on the content, but also on the semantics. We don't have the tag for who put this one together. So I'm trying to represent this information if anybody can volunteer. Les, was this you? Oh, Steve Eichner. I see. Steve Eichner was the person who represented it. Les, you've got a comment.
My comment was, I'm sorry. My comment was that do we need to mention CDS Hook someplace as a place to expand the standards for two-way communication, particularly beyond the notion that it comes back to the mailbox via direct, which then has to get routed and whatever, but it would seem to me that the two-way communication efforts should encompass CDS hooks in some way so that it can come to the point of care.
Yeah, I would generally concur that the appropriate standard for use of decision support for public health should probably leverage CDS hooks. Would you mind in the appropriate, I think it's in the other section where we're thinking about two-way communication, just making reference. So we don't want to make recommendations that ONC use CDS hooks, because we want ONC to be convening folks to appropriately explore the design space, but we can make reference that CDS hooks is a fit for purpose standard for decision support.
Okay, I'll go down and add that to the others.
Cool. And Hans has as always some additional additional context here in terms of whether we're doing decision support versus pushing information, and you know, the context for use is going to be different in each of those cases. All right, Steve, is Ike on?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So maybe you can represent. I was trying to represent your comments here, but maybe I'll let you represent your own comments.
Oh, I'll be perfectly content for you to do it. It's really looking at a focus on certification at the connection points. So looking at both the sender and the receiver
yep.
are capable of sending and or receiving as appropriate messages that are both syntactically correctly and semantically interoperable.
So definitely, I think we have broad consensus on that point. Would you mind taking another pass at turning that into recommendations text? So we recommend that ONC, and then you know, yeah, because right now this list lists as a set of desiderata, which is great. But then we need to be thoughtful about the ONC mechanisms for turning those desiderata into stuff. Cool. Thank you. And then I've got, we've got three more minutes. Let's go down one. And whoops, there's a lot more other arching here. I thought we were starting pretty far down. Cool. So item five was mine. With nice misspellings in it, we recommend that any certification for public health interoperability module and modular. So this is the point that we should be thoughtful about the role of, we should not be certifying whole systems, because in the real world for public health data systems, there's a mix of you know, potential intermediaries who are important in the chain. And you know, Ike points out in the observations that there is local law, policy, procurement limitations, et cetera. I tried to massage that down into recommend that any certification criteria for public health data system, I gotta go move all my chats. Public health data systems interoperability be modular, provide public health authorities maximal flexibility in selecting certified technology, which may be owned or managed or consumed as a service and or through intermediaries, yada, yada, according to according to legal policy, procurement rules governing public health. Hopefully I captured the sense of the task force. Happy to respond to folks who think we could word this better. Hearing none. I think we've got time. No, I don't think we've got time for one more. Let us go to public comment. And if we don't get any public comment, we'll go to one more.
All right. Thanks, Arian. As Arian noted, we're going to open up our call for public comments. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're on the phone only, press *9 to raise your hand. And once called upon, press *6. To mute and unmute your line. So let's pause for a moment to see if anyone raises their hand. Not seeing any hands raised, Arian, so I'll turn it back to you and Jillian.
Oh, sorry, if we do get a public comment in, we're happy to interrupt our deliberations and get the important public comment. But let's go back to pick up one more of these overarching or other comments. Making Liz go through gymnastics here. All right. So here I put the comment in, which I think is the same comment that that Ike previously that we discussed for under 63, disconnected certification interoperability. And I did not do the work of turning this into the we recommend text. So Ike, maybe you and I can collaborate on turning the synthesis of my number 6 and your, I think it was 53, into some definitive recommendation text.
Absolutely.
Yep. Fourteen, certifying use versus certifying systems. So it's really the same point that we're making in 6 and in 63, whatever it is that we're duplicate with. What we want is to, we want not just to certify, we want to certify that it works in practice, and close the gap between certification and use in practice, as opposed to, I think we can get a harmonized goal, here.
Arian, on this one, if I may make a comment, is that the technique that is being used for current certification is that the software is being certified, not the provider using it, but that there is real world testing that can confirm that what is actually certified and running in practice, that it works. And one of the questions I think that has been part of that is that trying to certify all the different users of the software might be a lot harder than having a combination of the software being certified and then other elements to make it manageable.
That's right. I'm trying to concentrate when I'm turning these things into recommendations on process outcomes as opposed to process inputs, for exactly that reason. We don't want to make recommendations of things that could be problematic in practice, but the recognition that I think it would be safe to say in the EHR certification program, we have sometimes had gaps between the demonstrated capabilities of EHRs in a certification program and the on the ground capabilities of that software. Sometimes and there are cases where there have been well-publicized legal cases, sometimes because the certified capability wasn't actually deployed. And then often because the types of data that are collected on the ground, that the certification process works only when the stars align and all the data are captured correctly. And that in the real world where you're capturing data in a much more messy way, or you've got older data, the certified capability does not conform to the implementation guide. But definitely, if you can help us with the drafting of this text and make reference to the real world testing program as well. But I think the key things here are, we want to certify to semantics, not just to content. We want to make sure our certification program is rigorous and provides a prima facie validation that the certified technology actually is available in practice. And then we want to enable some level of real world testing to verify that the certified product works as designed in the field. All right, we have one more minute.
This is Steve. I just want to interject really quickly.
Yeah.
We've seen, we need to get better information about what real world testing is actually occurring on both ends in terms of how is the real world testing being deployed. Is it who on the public health side, what exact systems are being used on the public health receiving end of it? What exact systems and what environments are being used in the real world testing environment? A pseudo real world deployment in a lab situation with straight code that's straight out of the box may be performing substantially different than real world testing after it's been installed in the field behind whatever firewalls and things that are in place in the real world.
Absolutely. Okay, I think we're going to have to leave it there because we are at time. We've got obviously a lot more to go, and just a reminder that we're going to take most of October to try to go through this information in good, this level of detail. We will extract recommendations into the formal transmittal draft. We will go over that transmittal as a draft. There'll be ample opportunity for people to cross-reference what's in the spreadsheet to what got into the draft. We'll go over it multiple times until we're all sick of it. And then once we're all sick of it, we'll just pass it on through from exhaustion to the full high tech. So I think we're in relatively good shape. We have a lot of work to do, but we're in relatively good shape to be able to get through the final transmittal on the 10th. So thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.